Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Anton von Leeuwenhoek. Now, this is someone who might be forgotten, but because we teach microscopy at school, we always mention him, and he's got a bit of a story to him. And this is a very Dutch scientist in a very Dutch world. So I'm dedicating this podcast to a Dutch friend of mine. Okay, so Anton von Leeuwenhoek, and it's also got mention of animals, so I think they'll like it. Anton von Leeuwenhoek, and it's got a typical Dutch name with far too many vowels hanging around with it, and I'll spell it to you. It's Leeuwenhoek. So it's, you know, you have to be Dutch to say it. From 1632 to 1723. So, you know, probably 91 years. Was one of the most unassuming scientists who has ever lived. Well, that just blows my head away, you know. That scientists would be assuming, oh God, spending all of his long life in Delft, where he was a draper. Well, I don't know. But in his back room, he discovered an entirely new world, a world of microscopic life, including bacteria, or not bacteria, he wouldn't have, bacteria are too small to be seen by things, protozoa, nematodes, which are worms, and rotifers, which are sort of these water bears, and human sperm and blood cells, possibly blood cells, even that, if you could see blood cells, that's pretty good. Bacteria are much smaller than blood cells. Yeah, so it's really beautiful to explore his writings and what he felt and all that type of stuff. So he's a much more accessible person, and he's not hooked into the grand, you know, grand tours, and he's not stuff like that. But let's listen to him. Until Leeuwenhoek started to work with his microscope, no one suspected that there was any kind of life too small to be seen with naked eye. And this very much is true. Now, it just one of those things, everyone had looked at the planets and stars and stuff like that, but just no one suspected it. Fleas were thought to be the smallest possible form of life, and they were clearly visible to sharp-eyed. No one had an inkling that they could be anything smaller. Then the microscope was invented. Then it was. No one quite knows who invented it. Craftsmen had probably been using drops of water and rock crystals to magnify their work for thousands of years, but the credit for creating a special apparatus to magnify usually goes to a Dutch spectacle maker in the late 16th century called Zacharias Janssen. He was skilled in grinding glass to make it magnify, and his breakthrough was to put two glass lenses together to dramatically increase the magnification. So I do have a lesson where you've given a set of lenses and you have to make a microscope. And by and by, kids actually do it. So it's the idea that you have a magnifying glass looking at the magnified image. Image there. So the first lens creates the magnified image, and then you have a magnifying glass further looking at it towards down there. Scientists soon began to catch on to the possibility of Janssen's microscope and to make improvements to it. In 1665, the great English scientist Robert Hooke, although I don't think we're going to have Hooke in here, are we? Just going to see if Hooke's in here. Oh yeah, thank goodness he's there. That would be a real poke in my spleen if they didn't have him. That's called Micrographia, which explained the basic principles of microscopy and contained the first drawing of a tiny living cell which can be seen inside a slice of cork. That's just complete and utter rubbish. So the slice of the living cell hadn't been completely removed by then, that stage. But it was never occurred to any of the scientists of the day to look for life with a microscope anywhere where it could not be seen with the naked eye. They simply used their microscopes to study things such as skin, close-up of corks or hairs. Lewis' brilliant insight, was to use the microscope to look at all kinds of places that he could not see life with the naked eye, particularly in liquids. He studied an extraordinary range of things since microscopes, raindrops, tooth plaque. Yeah, that's right, he actually scraped his teeth out to see his mouth. It's full of little living organisms. It's pretty amazing that when you sleep on life, you have this rogue cell, programmed cell, white blood cells can come out your tear duct and walk around your face and do battle with bacteria and then get back inside. It's pretty amazing. Sperm, blood, and much more besides. He actually went out to a lake and scooped up some lake water, which is interesting. Sperm, he particularly said, and I issued some sperm, but no, I got no enjoyment from it. I just part of it. It was here in these apparently lifeless substances that Leeuwenhoek discovered teeming richness of microscopic life. The humble draper. Leeuwenhoek was born in Delft on the 24th of October, 1632, of quite humble origins. His father was a basket maker. His mother's families were brewers. Very little is known about his childhood. Now, of course, if it was in ancient Greeks, people would say, he would then say, and then some speculated, and some wrote this, and before he was riding unicorns and dancing with whales and all of them. Okay, he walked to school in the nearby town of Warmond, and then, when he was 16, he became an apprentice to his uncle's linen drapery. Now, I suppose let's really go back. Did they have a bus? Did he have a horse? So it's reasonable to say that he walked. Did every child walk? Were there children on motorcycles zipping past all the other Dutch people? Was it on a canal and all that stuff? One doesn't know. Now, the important thing is that drapers had to actually use microscopes to count the very fine threads that's coming through. And set himself up as a draper and remained so for the rest of his 91 years. He was also appointed chamberlain to the Delft Council in 1660 and one of his trustees of estates of his friends, artist Jan Vermeer. He's actually a famous Dutch artist. I've been in Delft. It's actually quite a nice little place. They have a little Dutch, very Dutch museum to show the Dutch army, World War II, getting ready with machine guns mounted on dogs. It's sort of a very beautiful little museum. He married his first wife, Barbara, when he was 22. Yeah, my only problem is that, married and wife, he married someone who was to become... Oh, okay, doesn't matter, I'm a bit pedantic. They had five children, before Barbara died 12 years later, but only one of them, his daughter Maria, survived. Dear, you can imagine being a bit sad. He married again, but his second wife died too. And when she did, when Leeuwenhoek was a murderer, I don't know. Maria moved in with her father and cared for him with utter devotion for the rest of his life. The little household in Delft was completed by a long-haired dog, a talking parrot, and a quiet horse. Can imagine the horse wanting to speak but not getting a word nextwise with the parrot just going, wah, wah, wah. Homemade microscopes. No. Leeuwenhoek was probably inspired to take up microscopy sometime around 1668 after seeing a copy of Hooke's Micrographia. Now, it's 655 he published Micrographia, so one would guess that date would be possibly correct. But then it's also likely that he had the microscopes anyway from looking for counting thread Okay. But a single high quality... unlike Hooke, Leeuwenhoek did not use a two-lens compound microscope, but a single high-quality lens, which could be described simply as a magnifying glass rather than a microscope. Well, it's a high-quality lens, and you focus it directly. You know, you've got a compound lens using the other lens of your eye, so to speak. But the fact that he was a drapier was important. He had to count thread count, 300 threads per second, you know, to do it. And it was more linen. It wasn't, I suppose you could drape here, that's a poor translation of it. At such time, such simple microscopes were much less, much easier to get a clear picture with. Problems with blurring meant impossible to make compound microscopes. They magnified more than 20 to 30 times. But Leeuwenhoek was able to grind his own single-lens microscopes, and after years of honing his techniques, and with the help of an acute eyesight and careful lighting, he was able to see things clearly to magnifications over 200 times, something no one else managed to achieve for almost two centuries. Leeuwenhoek is known to have made over 500 of these single-lens microscopes, but only 10 survive, which is remarkable. Yeah, anyway, they were very simple devices, just a few inches long, with a lens mounted in a tiny hole in a brass plate. The specimen is mounted at a point that sticks up in front of the lens. Two screws move the specimen to focus. All else is needed is careful lighting and a very steady, sharp eye. Not sharp eyesight, not a sharp eye, would it, but I suppose I'm getting a bit involved. Letters to the Royal Society. Now, this is where it really comes alive to me. After a few years of perfecting his little microscopes, Leeuwenhoek began examining such things as mold and insects in incredible close-ups, seeing for the first time the complex structure of the bee's eyes. For instance, in 1773, Leeuwenhoek contacted the Dutch physician anatomist René de Graaf. I wonder if it's a Van de Graaf generator. To tell him that he had just found. Although just 32, de Graaf was already famous for the discovery of the egg-making sites. Oh! In follicles. Now, the fallopian, we now know, is the buddy of the anatomist, the Italian, and now the Graaf's is something, which is now in his name. De Graaf wrote to Henry Oldenburg, president of the Royal Society in London, the hub of 17th century science, about his fellow Dutchman and his marvellous microscope. Because of Graaf's reputations, Oldenburg at once invited Leeuwenhoek to write a letter to the society reporting his findings to be published in the Philosophical Transactions, the society's journals. And, of course, we're creating exactly the same thing under the noses of the Australian government. For the humble Dutch draper, the invitation would undoubtedly be rather overwhelming. In a letter accompanying the report, he wrote that he had never tried to publish his results because he was not sure he could express himself effectively. Nor could he speak Latin, the international language scientists used at the time. He wrote in Dutch and got a local man to translate it into Latin. Later letters were sent in Dutch and translated into English. Thank God. Leeuwenhoek's early observations were nothing startling, and his first letter reported no more than Hooke had seen a decade earlier. But it was well enough received, and Leeuwenhoek was encouraged to continue his work and go on sending letters to society. Go on, send us letters! In fact, he went on sending them 50 years and sent more reports than any member of the society before or since. Bloody Dutch. What's in the mail, love? Ah, oh, more Dutch junk mail. Oh, God, we're Delft. Amicules. These are the little things to see. And that, if I can say, what I like is getting people to get hair and print and stuff like that. Just in you just on one group, you just say, oh, and have a look at this water. And they go, what? And they start teaching everybody else about it. It's really rather fun. And then there's a few things. Okay. Although, this is so you get some water. And you get different amounts of water, and you get coloured water, and some drain water, and some green water. Okay, although Leeuwenhoek's first letter had not reported anything dramatic, he was perfecting his technique. There you go, you bastards. Then, in 1674, he reported seeing little creatures in the lake water. Quote, "I found floating therein divers earthly particles, and some green streaks, spirally round, serpent-wise, and orderly arranged after a manner of copper or tin worms, in the cillars used to cool their liquors as they distill over. The whole circumference of each of these streaks was about the thickness of a hair on one's head." It's the most remarkable letter. The most remarkable letter was letter number 18, which is, you know, blood oath. Get on to letter 18, which if most people could actually just skip straight and report a letter 18. In which he reports the discovery of what we now call bacteria in drops of water. Well, I'll be amazed if he could see that. But his discoveries did not stop there. In 1677, a drop of rainwater. In 1677, he described how he examined his own semen. It too was swarming with little animals that we now called sperm. But unlike the creatures of rainwater and animalcules, literally tiny animals, the semens were all identical. Well, they're not quite. Each of the many thousands he looked at had the same tiny tail and head and nothing else. He could see them swimming like tadpoles in this semen, oh yes, sperm. This was too much for others to believe, and it was decades before Leeuwenhoek's description of sperm was accepted. This is horrible to think, I mean, a mouthful of life. In letter 39, in 1683, Leeuwenhoek reports he examined his own saliva, plaque scraped from his teeth. He said the saliva came to animalcules, but the plaque was teeming with them, very prettily moving. The biggest sort, he said, had very strong and swift motion, and shot about like pike in water. The second sort oft-times spun like a top, and those were far more in number. He also said that plaque taken from his teeth after he began drinking scalding coffee contained animalcules. So he concludes heat from the coffee probably killed the little animals. He confirmed this when he found animalcules in plaque, then from the back of his teeth, not exposed directly to the coffee. I like that. A little later, Leeuwenhoek came close to realizing that bacteria can be germs that cause disease. And this is so cute, so long. He didn't see bacteria. Bacteria is far too small to be seen. And noted the dramatic increase in the number of animalcules in the mouth when he was ill and had a rotting tooth. Isn't that lovely, rotting tooth? This shows that the person writing this has got not a clue. People have sometimes been disappointed that Leeuwenhoek did not go one step further and identify bacteria as germs. And sometimes disappointed, I find that really just, what are you upset about? What pisses you off? Bloody Dutch Draper. It took another century before Louis Pasteur made that step. But in many ways, Leeuwenhoek's understanding was closer to our modern view of bacteria and the important, not beneficial, role they play in the world, as well as germs. I think this is a step closer to this Nong, doesn't understand what bacteria is. By the time he died, on the 26th of August, 1723, Leeuwenhoek was modestly famous. The Holy Emperor Roman Emperor visited his house to see his microscopic marvels. And so did Queen Mary of England and various other notable people. He never sought anything more than a quiet life with his daughter, microscope, and may I add, shaggy dog, talking parrot, and quiet horse, not thing. Several years before his death, he made a beautiful wooden cabinet to hold the best microscopes and specimens. When he died, his daughter Maria sent this to the Royal Society as he requested, and there it stayed for a century before mysteriously disappearing only for various items to appear in recent years. Despite his achievements, Leeuwenhoek was quite quickly forgotten. and his devoted daughter alone, who later erected a tiny monument to him in Delft, commemorating his great discoveries. Isn't that lovely? I wonder how big the monument is. That's so lovely, Maria. Discovering bacteria. Talk about sticking a pen up my nose. Leeuwenhoek's famous letter 18 was 17 and a half pages long and begins modestly enough as he goes through his scientific diary of the previous year. In the year 1675, about halfway through September, I discovered little creatures in the rain which had stood about for a few days in a tub that was painted blue within. See, this is beautiful. Leeuwenhoek thought that it was worth exploring what else there might be in the water for. As he said, these little animals, to my eye, were more than 10,000 times smaller than the water flea or sea louse, which you can see alive with the naked eye. He describes how, when examining water from different sources, rainwater, pond water, well water, sea water, so on, each leaf exposed to the air before he examined them. Each time he saw some of these incredibly tiny creatures, he was especially interested in those that seemed to have legs and tails and allow them to scurry about in the water. Quote, when some of the animals bestirred themselves, they sometimes stuck out two little horns which were continually moved after the fashion of horses' ears. It's not entirely certain what these creatures were, though we might guess they were... bacteria, a single cell, they've got a particular type of chitin-like exterior, like they cannot move, they may have that little... that just really upsets me. I wish I could remember the molecular structure outside bacteria. It's got lactic acid and a protein in its sugar, cellulose binding. But the Leeuwenhoek describes how he examined water that had been infused with ground pepper. And when he saw, what he saw there were clearly bacteria. This is just rubbish. These little creatures moved so little that he was not always sure they were alive. But there was enough clues. That's just so... I think he's referring to Brown's work. The idea that there were tens of thousands of tiny creatures in a single drop of water was so astounding that Henry Eulenburg asked Leeuwenhoek to provide independent witness to verify his finding. The Draper invited several of Delft's most respectable citizens, including the vicar, to look down the microscope. They confirmed what they saw. A year later, Hooke too confirmed the findings of his own observation performed in front of the expert witnesses, including Christopher Wren, the architect of St. Paul's Cathedral. Well, when in doubt, you always get in a vicar to do things. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.